extract of a letter containing an account of Lord Byron's residence in the island of Mitylene, account of Lord Byron's residence, and etc. The world was all before him, where to choose his place of rest and Providence his guide. In sailing through the Grecian archipelago on board one of His Majesty's vessels in the year 1812, we put into the harbor of Mitylene in the island of that name. The beauty of this place and the certain supply of cattle and vegetables always to be had there induced many British vessels to visit it, both men of war and merchantmen, and though it lies rather out of the track for ships bound to Smyrna, its bounties amply repay for the deviation of a voyage. We landed, as usual, at the bottom of the bay, and whilst the men were employed in watering and the pursuer bargaining for cattle with the natives, the clergyman and myself took a ramble to the cave called Homer's School, and other places where we had been before. On the brow of Mount Ida, a small monticule so named, we met with and engaged a young Greek as our guide, who told us he had come from Scio with an English lord, who left the island 4 days previous to our arrival in his felucca. "He engaged me as a pilot," said the Greek, "and would have taken me with him, but I did not choose to quit Mitylene, where I am likely to get married. He was an odd, but a very good man." The cottage over the hill, facing the river, belongs to him, and he has left an old man in charge of it. He gave Dominic, the wine trader, 600 zeshins for it, about 250 English pounds, and is resided there about 14 months, though not constantly, for he sails in his felucca very often to the different islands. This account excited our curiosity very much, and we lost no time in hastening to the house where our countryman had resided. We were kindly received by an old man who conducted us over the mansion. It consisted of 4 apartments on the ground floor, an entrance hall, a drawing room, a sitting parlor, and a bedroom, with a spacious closet annexed. They were all simply decorated, plain green stained walls, marble tables on either side, a large myrtle in the center, and a small fountain beneath, which could be made to play through the branches by moving a spring fixed in the side of a small bronzed Venus in a leaning posture. A large couch or sofa completed the furniture. In the hall stood half a dozen English cane chairs and an empty bookcase. There were no mirrors, nor a single painting. The bedchamber had merely a large mattress spread on the floor with 2 stuffed cotton quilts and a pillow, the common bed throughout Greece. In the sitting room we observed a marble recess, formerly, the old man told us, filled with books and papers, which were then in a large seaman's chest in the closet. It was open, but we did not think ourselves justified in examining the contents. On the tablet of the recess lay Voltaire's, Shakespeare's, Bolio, and Rousseau's works complete, Volney's Ruins of Empires, Zimmermann, in the German language, Klopstock's Messiah, Kotzebue's novels, Schiller's Play of the Robbers, Milton's Paradise Lost, an Italian edition, printed at Parma in 1810. Several small pamphlets from the Greek press at Constantinople, much torn, but no English book of any description. Most of these books were filled with marginal notes written with a pencil in Italian and Latin. The Messiah was literally scribbled all over and marked with slips of paper, on which were also remarks. The old man said, "The Lord had been reading these books the evening before he sailed and forgot to place them with the others, but," said he, "there they must lie until his return, for he is so particular that were I to move one thing without orders, he would frown upon me for a week together. He is otherwise very good. I once did him a service, and have the produce of this farm for the trouble of taking care of it, except 20 zeshins which I pay to an aged Armenian who resides in a small cottage in the wood, and whom the Lord brought here from Adrianople. I don't know for what reason." The appearance of the house, externally, was pleasing. The portico in front was 50 paces long and 14 broad, and the fluted marble pillars with black plinths and fretwork cornices, as it is now customary in Grecian architecture, were considerably higher than the roof. The roof, surrounded by a light stone balustrade, was covered by a fine Turkey carpet, beneath an awning of strong coarse linen. Most of the housetops are thus furnished, as upon them the Greeks pass their evenings in smoking, drinking light wine such as Lacryma Christi, eating fruit, and enjoying the evening breeze. On the left hand, as we entered the house, a small streamlet glided away. Grapes, oranges, and limes were clustering together on its borders, and under the shade of 2 large myrtle bushes a marble scat with an ornamental wooden back was placed, on which, we were told, the Lord passed many of his evenings and nights till 12 o'clock, reading, writing, and talking to himself. "I suppose," said the old man, praying, for he was very devout, and always attended our church twice a week besides Sundays. The view from this seat was what may be termed a bird's-eye view. A line of rich vineyards led the eye to Mount Kalkla, covered with olive and myrtle trees in bloom, and on the summit of which an ancient Greek temple appeared in majestic decay. A small stream issuing from the ruins descended in broken cascades until it was lost in the woods near the mountain's base. The sea, smooth as glass, and an horizon unshadowed by a single cloud, terminates the view in front. And a little on the left, through a vista of lofty chestnut and palm trees, several small islands were distinctly observed, studding the light blue wave with spots of emerald green. I seldom enjoyed a view more than I did this, but our inquiries were fruitless as to the name of the person who had resided in this romantic solitude. None knew his name but Dominic, his banker, who had gone to Candia. "The Armenian," said our conductor, "could tell, but I'm sure he will not." "And cannot you tell, old friend?" said I. "If I can," said he, "I dare not." We had not time to visit the Armenian, but on our return to the town we learnt several particulars of the isolated lord. He had portioned 8 young girls when he was last upon the island, and even danced with them at their nuptial feast. He gave a cow to one man, horses to others, and cotton and silk to the girls who lived by weaving these articles. He also bought a new boat for fishermen who had lost his own in a gale, and he often gave Greek testaments to the poor children. In short, he appeared to us, from all we collected, to have been a very eccentric and benevolent character. One circumstance we learnt, which our old friend at the cottage thought proper not to disclose. He had a most beautiful daughter with whom the Lord was often seen walking on the seashore, and he had bought her a pianoforte and taught her himself the use of it. Such was the information with which we departed from the peaceful Isle of Mitylene, our imaginations all on the rack, guessing who this rambler in Greece could be. He had money, it was evident. He had philanthropy of disposition, and all those eccentricities which mark peculiar genius. Arrived at Palermo, all our doubts were dispelled, falling in company with Mr. Foster, the architect, a pupil of Wyatt's, who had been traveling in Egypt and Greece. "The individual," said he, "about whom you are so anxious is Lord Byron. I met him in my travels on the islands of Tenedos, and I also visited him at Mitylene. We had never then heard of his lordship's fame, as we had been some years from home, but Child Harold being put into our hands, we recognized the recluse of Kalkla in every page. Deeply did we regret not having been more curious in our researches at the cottage, but we consoled ourselves with the idea of returning to Mitylene on some future day, but to me that day will never return. I make this statement, believing it not quite uninteresting, and in justice to his lordship's good name, which has been grossly slandered. He has been described as of an unfeeling disposition, averse to associating with human nature, or contributing in any way to soothe its sorrows, or add to its pleasures. The fact is directly the reverse, as may be plainly gathered from these little anecdotes. All the finer feelings of the heart, so elegantly depicted in his lordship's poems, seem to have their seat in his bosom. Tenderness, sympathy, and charity appear to guide all his actions, and his courting the repose of solitude is an additional reason for marking him as a being on whose heart religion hath set her seal, and over whose head benevolence hath thrown her mantle. No man can read the preceding pleasing traits without feeling proud of him as a countryman. With respect to his loves or pleasures, I do not assume a right to give an opinion. Reports are ever to be received with caution, particularly when directed against man's moral integrity, and who dares justify himself before that awful tribunal where all must appear, alone may censure the errors of a fellow mortal. Lord Byron's character is worthy of his genius. To do good in secret and shun the world's applause is the surest testimony of a virtuous heart and self-approving conscience. The end.